Coming up on Boston Public Radio, yesterday's federal report on climate change has particularly bad news for the Northeast. We'll ask Heather Goldstone what's in store for us and our kids and whether help is on the way. Then, do you talk to people on the subway, make eye contact with strangers? Some of us avoid it like the plague. Harvard's Michael Norton will explain why such social interactions benefit everyone, and then we'll get your take. Plus, Globe editor Brian McGrory on his paper's damning spotlight series on the college rental ghetto, then his dinner encounter with Monica Lewinsky.
Global Post Charles Sennett updates us on the horrific kidnapping of 300 Nigerian schoolgirls and European pressure to rethink our death penalty after a botched Oklahoma execution. Then, New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast on her new memoir. It's both an hysterically funny and harrowing account of caring for her aging parents. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7. It's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So here is
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Here is President Obama speaking from the White House Rose Garden just yesterday.
This is not some distant problem of the future. This is a problem that is affecting Americans right now.
Now, you'd think the president was talking about poverty, Social Security running out, student loan debt, but to think that he's actually talking about climate change is stunning.
This is not some distant problem of the future. This is a problem that is affecting Americans right now.
That was not a mistake, by the way. I chose to play it twice. I want to be clear here. The president was responding to a new comprehensive report on climate change. It was unveiled at the White House yesterday. The results are in, and what we are now actively living amongst are changes that we have reaped in the environment. Joining us to talk about what this means, and in particular, what it means for our part of the country, is Heather Goldstone. Heather is WGBH News' science editor and has reported extensively on climate change in New England. Heather, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for joining us, as Jim just said. Listen, I was like, this was very upsetting to me, this new federal report, and it's particularly scary for the Northeast. Give us the highlights.
Well, there are a number of highlights. For the Northeast, one of the things that they really put forward in this report is the fact that we are seeing increases in precipitation, and particularly in intense precipitation events, these very heavy downpours. We've seen a 71% increase in these kinds of downpour, heavy precipitation events in recent decades. I think that's probably something most of us can relate to. We see it every spring now, that it doesn't seem like it rains just a little bit every few days, that we get these downpours and then nothing for a while.
Right.
That's one of those, I think, climate change impacts where it seems like, oh, well, what's the big deal? We're going to get a little bit more rain. It'll be heavier rain, no big deal. But that definitely has impacts in terms of flooding. I mean, if you're getting a ton of rain all at once, the ground can't necessarily absorb it. You're going to be more prone to flooding. And it also has ecosystem impacts, ecological impacts. I mean, if you think about it, if you get sprayed by a fire hose once a month, that's not going to keep you hydrated and healthy. Just getting these intense downpours once in a while isn't going to be as good for ecosystems as, say, getting rain on a regular basis. So that's one where we've seen a really stark increase already, and that's just predicted to keep going.
And Heather Goldstone, a lot of these numbers, I'm glad you filled in the blanks and made them real. When you read in this report that 2 degrees increase in temperature over the past century, and if we do nothing, which is apparently what we're doing right now, except in states like Massachusetts, an additional 10 degree increase, in the next 7 years, if that were to happen, if we don't do something to stem the tide, literally and figuratively, what would a 10-degree increase in this part of the country mean in 2080?
Well, that's really hard to know exactly what it would mean. But a few things. Definitely, we are already seeing more and more intense heat waves, and that would definitely increase, because it's not just that the whole temperature edges up evenly. We see a lot more of these extremes with the heat waves. We're already seeing a longer frost-free season, not just in New England, but everywhere. Spring arrives in New England. We saw a report last year saying about a week earlier than it used to. Fall, warmer temperatures last a little bit longer into the fall. That means a longer growing season, but that also means that more pests are able to survive. We see the spread of contagious diseases that used to be confined to warmer areas. Those are going to make their way north into New England. Just more extreme weather in general. And then also, you know, one thing that has been talked about a lot in the past couple of years and is still a little bit uncertain, I would say, in the scientific realm, but is going to be hurricanes. That is, especially if you see this major increase in both air temperatures, it's also going to increase ocean water temperatures. And that has the potential to fuel more and more intense hurricanes like, you know, Hurricane Sandy that we saw recently hit New Jersey and New York.
Heather Goldstein, I'm glad you brought up Hurricane Sandy because Emily Rooney on WGBH, you may have been on this night, actually, but I'm not sure if you were. But there was a report about had Hurricane Sandy hit Boston that talked about the back, not just the Back Bay, which we knew was always vulnerable because it's so below sea level or at sea level. Fenway Park being under like 8 feet of water.
And before you respond, we should say that same thing said. And had there just been, what, an 8 or 10 degree shift in the hurricane, it would have hit Boston.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely something that was a concern, was whether or not we were going to see impacts from Sandy, more impacts from Sandy in eastern Massachusetts than we did see. And that's a possibility, although we've seen a couple of storms kind of take that track now up through New York City and kind of up into New England. But yeah, I mean, Boston is very susceptible and cities as a whole are very susceptible to the storm surge, these kinds of more extreme weather, and particularly as sea level continues to rise. So as the water gets warmer, it's expanding. We're seeing sea level rise from that. We're also here in New England. It's kind of funny to think about sea level rise not being consistent all around the globe, but it's not. And we're seeing sea level rise faster on the coast of New England than in other parts of the world. And these
Okay,
so there are a few reasons. One goes all the way back to glaciers. And if you think about the continent of North America, kind of like a seesaw, as the glaciers moved back away and actually created Cape Cod and some of our coastline, we kind of bounced up. And now, 15 to 18,000 years later, we're kind of sinking as Canada bounces up. And so the whole East Coast is seeing more relative sea level rise because of that. There's also a really interesting phenomenon that as the oceans get warmer, some of the ocean currents, like the Gulf Stream, may slow down. And there's suggestion that we've seen a very slight impact on the Gulf Stream already. What the Gulf Stream does along the coast of New England is basically suck water and pull it out away from the coast. So if that slows down a little, water could basically pile up along the coast of New England. So there are a few reasons that the global average is about 8 inches over the past century of sea level rise. We've seen closer to 11.
And by the way, what was implicit in Marjorie's question was she wants to know when she and her sister have to move out of the family house outside of Hyannis.
And you talk about these little narrow sections like East Ham and Truro, but all of Cape Cod could be submerged by the in decades to come by the sound of this report.
Well, definitely there's reason for concern for coastal property owners, no doubt about that. And we will definitely see changes in the shape of Cape Cod. But I have put this question to multiple geologists and ocean scientists, and they say that Cape Cod will still be here in 100 years. It will still be here in 1,000 years. It will look different. In fact, Cape Cod is the result of these glacial climate change events and sea level rise, you know, that when it was first formed, it was just rocks that were left behind by glaciers. And we've been seeing sea level change. It's just been in the past 2,000 years that it's been fairly stable, and that's what we've gotten used to seeing as the shape of Cape Cod, but it's always changed.
Okay.
We're talking to Heather Goldstone, WGBH News' science editor. You know, of all the numbers that stood out, and the Globe did a good job capturing the impacts in the Northeast this morning, and I had to read this a couple of times and then mention it to Marjorie because I couldn't believe it wasn't a typo. In the southern north, they call it 12 northeastern states. In the southern part of the Northeast, they're predicting that if nothing is done, again, if we don't do more governmentally, industrially, that there will be 60 more 90-plus degree days.
The reality is
that's essentially wiping out the whole elderly population in some of these communities. And then one of our colleagues mentioned the irony is, and we have 60 more 90-degree days, which means much more air conditioning use, which means much more climate change impact. I mean, that to me is just staggering, Heather Goldstone.
And that's really, you're hitting on a couple of the themes that this report, this most recent National Climate Assessment, was hitting on. First of all, our vulnerabilities. Absolutely. We've already seen that as heat waves have gotten more intense, one signature of the greenhouse gas theory and greenhouse gas warming is that nighttime temperatures don't fall as much. And so the heat maintains overnight. And that takes a huge human toll. When our bodies don't have that chance overnight to recover a little bit from the heat, you see the death rate go up, especially in the elderly population. And then, of course, there are all these interdependencies. It's not just that it's hotter and people are feeling the effects of the heat, but as you mentioned, there's going to be more demand for air conditioning, which means more demand for electricity, which means more demand for water necessary to cool. And you get all of these cascading effects that can have really far-reaching effects through different sectors of the economy and different regions of the nation.
Heather, just a couple more things from me. Is as depressing as this whole report was, what is equally depressing is the utter inaction on the part of Congress. They talk about how Massachusetts is one of the few states that's attempting to deal with this, but it's not being replicated elsewhere. What was really depressing to me, in the section where it talked about the temperature increasing potentially 10 degrees in the Northeast over the next 70 years until 2080, they say if we do something, the temperature will still rise 3 to 6 degrees in the Northeast, which seems to me, as someone who doesn't have your level of expertise, is pretty catastrophic as well. It's obviously better than 10 degrees, but that is a huge temperature increase in a very short period of time.
Yeah, I think that's something that has really changed about the message coming from scientists about climate change over the past few years. And that is really the main message of this report. This is not about the future. This is about things already happening and what is inevitably going to happen, even if we were to go cold turkey on greenhouse gas emissions today, we would still, as you said, see warming because of the greenhouse gases still left in the atmosphere. We would still see some degree of sea level rise. And so this is about limiting our liability, essentially, not about avoiding the impacts of climate change.
Well, you know what I thought was another big takeaway from this, Heather Goldstone, is that the piece says that all this climate change, or a lot of it, is the result of human action. Of course, that's a very controversial political question. And I'm wondering, does this kind of doom is coming make any difference? Do the people that are climate change deniers, are they swayed by this? I mean, you have the National Academy of Sciences weighing in on this, federal agencies and so forth. Is this going to be dismissed out of hand as a Obama political kind of thing, or will this have any more impact?
Well, certainly a report that is being portrayed as coming out of the White House, I think, is going to be susceptible to the argument that this is political in some way. And you make a good distinction there, because there is a political debate about climate change, but there really isn't a scientific debate. There are aspects of uncertainty and debate on some of, you know, the more details and smaller aspects of things. But on the big picture, it's happening. It's happening now. It presents a risk, and it's largely caused by humans. That's not up for debate in the scientific community. And there's been a real lag between what scientists are talking about and what the public is talking about. And there's, in recent years, been a lot of research going into why is that the case. And there's some really interesting stuff that it's not necessarily just that there are political agendas and propaganda. There certainly is that. That's one aspect of it. People have pointed the finger at the media for not telling the right story, and that's probably part of it as well. But there also appear to be parts of our human psychology that make it hard to deal with a problem like this. We're not necessarily great at assessing a risk that is kind of slow moving and largely invisible. And it can be really hard to just take this in and accept that there's such an overwhelming problem that often feels like we can't really do much about it as individuals.
Yeah, that's where I'm so glad you said that, Heather Goldstone, because I have said to virtually every elected official who's been in the studio when we're talking about long range problems, whether the transportation or climate change or whatever it is it's much easier to deal with an immediate problem that's in the face of your constituent and explain to him or her how they're going to see immediate impacts. If you spend a ton of political capital on this problem that is real and, as the president and you say, is here now, the constituent doesn't see any impact. You have to basically say to them, trust me, this is going to be great for your kids and your grandkids. And so it makes it a really hard sell, even when the data is as overwhelming as you suggest.
Well, and I think that as these impacts are becoming more and more visible, I think we're going to start to see a shift. And we have seen in public polls in the past few years a shift in public perceptions. After a couple of years of really extreme weather, people start to say, I think the climate is affecting the weather that I'm seeing. And there's also an aspect of just penetration in the media and the places that we consume information. I mean, we hear, you know, the stock market numbers multiple times on every news show, right? We don't hear about changes in temperature or changes in carbon dioxide levels at that same frequency. And so I think there is a disconnect there in terms of how much we think we're seeing or feeling that is related to climate change.
Yeah, but I hear you, but let me just say very quickly before we let you go, because this whole thing was called global warming in the beginning, which in my opinion was a huge mistake, we continue, turn on any radio station, turn on any television show during a colder than normal spring like we had a couple of weeks ago, and you have every single cynic on the street with a mic in his or her face saying, yeah, we're really suffering from global warming. It's the coldest it's ever been in April. And so I hope you're right that the public is closer to accepting reality. But I have to say, I see too much anecdotal denying that makes me trouble. But in any case, Heather Goldstone, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah,
my
Heather,
pleasure.
Thank you. Maybe everybody's increased allergies. Look at everybody going, because that's a big problem.
Can I say one thing to you, too?
What?
Before
I'm
you
in
switch,
a panic.
Before you switch, before people decide, as is the knee-jerk way here, to blame all the Republicans who are deniers in Congress,
Democrats
from
yes.
coal-producing states are as much a part of the problem as are the Republicans who just say no to doing anything about climate change. So it's a bipartisan a problem.
Those Democrats are worried about taking away the jobs of their constituents.
Exactly.
So you get their concern, but I mean, this is pretty frightening. And Heather Goldstone, thanks so much for being with us here to explain it. Heather Goldstone is a WGBH News science editor. Dr. Heather Goldstone holds a PhD in ocean science and has reported extensively on climate change. Up next, new research finds that letting strangers into your life instead of locking them out with your earbuds and downcast eyes could be good for you. Behavior economist Michael Norton joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
Jim Fitzgerald,
Kim Draper,
Deborah Farwell, Susan B. Jones,
Sandra Papson,
Ron and Linda Morse,
Elizabeth Eaton.
Thank you. To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Bentley University, offering a new 11-month Bentley MBA with immersive field-based collaborations with hands-on experience at their 3 MBA programs and all 7 of their Masters of Science degrees. Bentley, the business university. And It's Your Move, Inc., a move management company specializing in the planning, orchestrating, and execution of moves for senior citizens, helping families sort through and organize treasures collected over a lifetime. It'sYourMoveInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. So for anybody who took public transportation to work today, here's a question for you. Did you close yourself off from your fellow commuters by averting eye contact, as I would have? Did you shield yourself from the threat of innocuous chit-chat by wearing headphones? Did you do yourself a favor by shutting out mankind for a little me time? Well, if you did, apparently all of your instincts are wrong. We're going to get your take on this in a couple of minutes. But first, here with us in Studio 3 to explain why you should let strangers into your life rather than shutting them out is Harvard Business School behavioral economist Michael Norton. Michael's the co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael, great to see you again.
Great to be back.
So, Michael, tell us why people like Jim Browdy, whose rule in life is to avoid eye contact at every possibility all the time, why are people like Jim wrong about the opportunities they're missing?
I think, you know, it's not just Jim. It's really all of us, in some sense, have this theory in our minds that the best thing to do in everyday life is to not look at anyone and never talk to anyone and stare at our phone and make sure that we can't have any contact with anyone. And really, the research says it's wrong, that actually when we step out of that mindset of being alone and quiet and private, that we'll actually be a lot happier.
You wrote a piece, New York Times opinion piece with a colleague, Elizabeth Dunn, called Hello, Stranger. Explain what the research was. What did people do to come to the conclusion you did, Michael?
A very interesting study out of the University of Chicago that they actually made people talk to strangers. So they
by paying them off.
Exactly.
Wasn't much, though.
$5 Starbucks card.
I was amazed they do it for $5. I thought you'd have to give them $20 at least to get them to talk to people on the subway or the T. But go ahead.
Okay,
what happens?
Give them $5 of Starbucks. Then what happens?
And they put them on a bus. They put them on a train. And they basically tell some people, you know what, do what you usually do. and they just let them do whatever. And other people, they said, in order to get this gift card from us, you have to talk to the person next to you, whatever you want to talk about. They didn't give me any advice, actually, on what to do. They just said, strike up a conversation. Then they called him up later, and they said, how are you feeling? And people who kept to themselves, the train ride wasn't bad, but they weren't happy about it. It was business as usual. But people who talked to other people, even though they said there's no way that could possibly be good, they were happier because they chatted.
And they also said that people felt intimidated by trying to open a conversation with somebody else on the subway or the bus. But what happened when they did try to initiate those conversations?
It's funny. So if you ask people, do people want to talk to you? Everybody says, no, they don't want to talk to me. But if you ask, would you like to talk to someone else? Most of us say, sure, that would be fine. So all of us think we're the only person who doesn't want, nobody wants to talk to us. But if all of us don't mind if someone talks to us, we're just getting it wrong, actually. And really, people don't mind if you just say to them, nice day we're having, and all you say back is, yes, it is, that even those little tiny interactions actually are better than sitting in silence and staring at our phone.
So why? Why is that, those little tiny interactions are better for us? Why?
So one of the funny things about when we meet people is because we care so much about what other people think about us, even complete strangers, is that we try. We just try. We smile. We look at them. We try to strike up a conversation. And just that little amount of putting effort can make us – we're smiling at them. They're smiling back. Those little tiny things actually make us happier, especially compared to staring out the window at traffic. It's got to be better to chat than to do those sorts of things.
And the beauty of this, I was hoping when I was reading your piece that you were going to say this only works on the subway because I don't take the subway much and I don't have to worry about it. But you go on to say that essentially in all casual social interactions, you're about to pay your $5 to the cashier for a small cup of coffee at Starbucks or whatever. You talk to the barista, it's going to improve your day and his or hers as well?
That's exactly right. We think, especially when we're transacting with service people, that we should really keep it like business. Instead, again, the research shows that when you chat, and it's not a 5-hour conversation about your life goals, it's just a little brief conversation, just making a connection with other people almost always beats keeping to yourself.
Do you speak German, Michael Norton, from Harvard Business School?
I do not.
Okay. Well, there's this great German phrase. I'm not even going to try to say it because I don't speak German either. But translated, it means to be looked at as though air. And I thought that was great. And how is that relevant to this research, Michael Norton?
It's this really fascinating study where they put people in a horrible situation where they had people look at them as though they were trying to look through them. And if it's ever happening, you can try it out actually on somebody today.
Parties all the time. People either looking through me or looking over my head.
Yes, who's their famous person
exactly.
Somewhere. I get that too.
Yeah.
Turns out when people look at us like we're not people, it's really upsetting. We feel like, what's wrong with me? Why doesn't anybody like me? And even just having someone look at us, make eye contact, acknowledge us, is a way to feel better about your day.
You know, one of the things you wrote here, you cited the study from the early 2004 published in Science, commuting is associated with fewer positive emotions than any daily activity. And when I read it, I was saying, oh my goodness, but then I wasn't surprised. Should I be? I mean, one shouldn't be. I mean, it is for the most part, with the exception of people who love the solitude and can listen to music and calm down and that sort of thing, it's totally wasted time in a fairly limited day. That's why that conclusion is reached, right?
Absolutely. And unlike other negative things that happen to us in our lives, as you said, it's every single day. So the dentist is not fun, but we don't have to do it every single morning for an hour for the rest of our lives.
So right. You did this. When was the last time you took the subway or a public bus, Michael Norton? Tell the truth.
Took the subway a couple days ago.
Okay.
Actually.
Did you talk to anybody? No way. Did you?
I actually did talk.
Because of this or because you're that kind of person?
Because of this, actually. So
okay.
I
so what
have
happened?
Changed my behavior.
So what? Explain what happened.
I actually talked to the driver.
Of the bus.
Wow.
Of the subway.
Of the subway? I thought you're not supposed to do that.
So I was standing outside when they're leaning out, uh-huh. And they stopped to let someone on. They reopened the doors and let someone on the way they do, uh-huh. And I was waiting for the next train. And I just said, that was really nice of you to let that person on. And I think the guy really I don't know if he did. He really appreciated it. But I noticed that I felt good about it. And all I said to him was, thanks for doing that.
And why do you think you felt good about it?
I think, he was shocked. I don't think our public transportation workers get a lot of positive.
No,
because I made somebody else happy. Is that what it was?
Yeah,
is that why it
I think
came
so.
Back to you?
He helped someone, and I acknowledged that he. I didn't do anything, but I felt good about the interaction anyway.
Can I give you tell you this gives me hives. The whole thing. Why don't you tell your experience, by the way, before we take phone calls, just to show that it's not uniform. What happened to you a number of years ago when you talked to somebody on the subway?
This was a long time ago, but I was on the Green Line, and the Green Line was delayed. And so I was standing next to this guy who was in his early 20s, and we were complaining about the train being delayed.
Sounds good, right, Michael, so far? Good, okay.
We were going to be late, and he was very well dressed. I remember he had a raincoat on, and I don't know if he had a suit, but he had, you know, was dressed well. And we get to the stop on Arlington Street, which is a pretty snazzy stop. I get out. The guy mugs me. I couldn't believe it. He stole all my Christmas money. And I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. I was talking to this guy for like at least 2 or 3 minutes, and then he knocked me over and stole my purse. So it doesn't always
no,
work
except
out.
It made him happier.
So it did make him happy.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Michael Morton was half right.
We caught him. So it didn't make him so happy after that. But I want to ask you about one other thing, and then we can take some calls on this. And by the way, we're talking with Michael Norton from Harvard Business School about this kind of astounding bit of research that says if you interact with people on the subway or the bus and you don't sit there with your earbuds on and looking at your cell phone, you will have a more enjoyable experience during your commute. You also talked about this phenomenon, which I get this. This is really true. How, you know, you kind of go home at the end of the day to your spouse, your significant other, and you may complain about everything that happened to you during the day. But that really, if you act with the spouse like you would act with a stranger, kind of perky and nice, what's the effect of that?
I was actually wondering which one of you was going to bring this up.
Makes perfect sense to me.
It's true. So, you know, when we know somebody so well and we get home and we see them, we just kind of often lounge around and complain about our day. But you wouldn't do that with a stranger. You would never walk up to a stranger and just start complaining about your day. You try. That's the key thing. You try with strangers. You try to smile. You try to engage them. You find something they're interested in to talk about and talk to them about it. And sometimes we forget to do that with our partners because we know them so well. But you're right. If we treat them in an odd way like strangers, we can actually have a more pleasant evening than if we do business as usual.
There's a book in that. Treat your partner like a stranger.
Wipe out the divorce rate.
877-301-8970. We want to know, are you up to the challenge? Are you willing to chat up a stranger to make eye contact with your fellow man? Are you someone who does this already, or are you among the misanthropes, sort of like me, who wants nothing to do with, is the saying we've been using a lot lately, the unknown unknowns. I find this, I mean, I guess intellectually I accept it, but it is, people are so angry about some, maybe this is why it works, I guess, because there's so much in their shell. It's just, it's amazing to me. And by the way, the results are not occasional. The results, at least according to what I read that you wrote, are overwhelming, that overwhelmingly both ends of this interaction, the cashier, the person sitting next to you on the subway, whoever it is, whatever social casual interaction you have, the outcome for that both individuals is positive. Is that not what you're saying?
That's right. There are, of course, some interactions that go badly. But
like Marjorie's, for
example.
Exactly.
But on average,
it only happened once.
It's better to
or
chat.
Twice.
Okay, let's take some calls and see if which side of this fence you're on. And by the way, if you're one of the people who doesn't make eye contact and doesn't initiate these kinds of interactions, are you going to change your ways as a result of this discussion? Melissa, you're in Worcester. You're on with Michael Norton on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thanks. I love your show.
Thank you
for taking my call.
Thank you.
But anyway, I do always make eye contact, and I talk to all my cashiers, and I'm very friendly that way. But I wanted to say I was on a Greyhound bus like 14 and a half years ago, and I talked to a stranger, and now I'm married to him for the past 10 years.
So who's
so,
wait, stop. Who started the conversation, Melissa?
He did.
And how did you react when what did he say to you, and what was your immediate reaction to this guy stuffed into a bus talking to you?
We were on a rest area, and he just started talking to me, and I don't remember the first thing, but you know, we were actually in Florida, and he lived here at the time and I lived in Virginia, so we had a ways to go. And so it was nice, and so we started talking, and we got back on the bus, and then we were ahead of schedule, of all things, on the Greyhound, so we had 2 hours in North Carolina where we really started talking,
I
and we changed the dresses, And that's why I live here now.
Okay, Melissa, I want to know whether your husband is really adorable and cute and you thought that in the first seconds, or whether he grew on you during the course of this bus ride.
I thought he was pretty cute to begin with, yeah. But he certainly grew on me as the time went
okay.
on.
Hey, Melissa, that's a great story. Thanks for starting us off. So part of the problem, now, Melissa is a different situation. Unlike a subway ride, the beauty of starting an interaction is you know you can end it pretty quickly because right. you can get off the subway or the other person. How about in a setting like that's pretty dangerous. I don't mean dangerous physically. I don't have any idea if it is. But the problem is when you invite or accept that kind of outreach in something that has a longer shelf life, you really could get yourself in a mess, couldn't you? And like on a plane ride, talking to like, just you watch Mad Men?
Yeah.
Did you see when Don Draper was talking to the woman when he's flying back from California?
Yeah.
I mean, that led to an odd situation. But how do you deal with that?
So I think actually people often, when we talk about this research, they think of the worst case scenario.
Right.
So I actually think when she said 14 and a half years ago, I thought she was going to say I had a bad interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do is we think about, oh, my God, imagine if I got trapped talking to this person. But that's almost never what happens. We just have a brief conversation. But the other thing that we've heard from a huge number of people who met their partner talking to a stranger on a train or a bus or a plane. It really happens a lot. And if you think about why, anyone you are with, anyone that you married, they started out as a stranger.
Right.
You have to talk to strangers to end up with friends and to end up with a partner, or you'd never end up with anybody. We just don't think about strangers as a source of possible happiness and friendship.
You know why? I'm trying to figure out why I was so shocked by these results. Here's what I think it is because people are so worried about crime, for example, right now, a la Marjorie. You start a conversation with somebody. Oh, my God, what's it going to lead to? If a person starts a conversation with another person, is he or she going to think I'm coming on to them? I mean, isn't that a great inhibitor for people, both those things?
It is, but I think it's the worst case scenario thinking.
Oh,
again,
the same thing.
You know, as opposed to maybe we'll chat for 3 minutes and have a laugh about the Red Sox and carry on with our lives kind of thing. You know, that's the more common interaction.
You know, before we go to the next phone call, I just want to ask you: is part of this, especially on the T of the subway, the idea that we're all in this same boat together? We're sharing this moment or this commute. Is that part of it?
I think it can be a share. So often when a train breaks down is when people start talking
to
each other out of boredom. And that's bad that it broke down, but it can be good that it broke down because you're chatting.
Okay.
But actually, my co-author Liz Dunn and I were talking about, imagine you're really packed in a subway car so that we're touching each other already. Then it would be very strange for us to start chatting.
Oh, no, course. No,
you're so close.
Yeah, so there has to be some distance. So it's very interesting to think about the questions you're asking, what are the kinds of random interactions that actually turn out well?
Yeah.
And what are the kind that might really go awry?
You never know when someone's pressed up against you in the subway if they're pressed up against you because it's crowded or because they have an ulterior motive. Okay, let's go to Elisa in Boston. What do you think about talking with people in the subways and cashiers, et cetera, Elisa?
Hi there.
Hi, I feel great about it. You guys are actually having my dream conversation on the radio right now because I'm a huge advocate of public transportation and of, you know, smiling at people on the street and saying hello, because it's just like what you're talking about, like starting that conversation, starting that interaction that can change somebody's day, that can change somebody's outlook, it can change their life. And I'm also calling because my sister met her husband on the train. He'd come here from England. He'd only been here for 2 weeks. They met on the train. They've been married for 8 years now. They just had their first baby. And my husband, we're together because he asked me out on the train.
This is unbelievable. Forget dating bars. People should just ride on public transportation.
I know.
Alyssa, we got to let you go because the connection's horrible. I'm sorry, but thank you for a great call.
You know, here's a great email from Annie. She says, when I moved to Massachusetts, the Massachusetts suburbs from Oklahoma in high school, I was amazed that so few people chatted with the folks around them. It was standard practice to just say hi to others back in Oklahoma. Is this a regional
thing? That's a great question, yeah.
Absolutely. So there's huge regional differences on how much eye contact you make, whether you say hello to people. Absolutely. And cities are one of the worst places for saying hello. And particular, by the way, East Coast cities. People tend to be – people who move to the East Coast from the Midwest, one of the first things they say is no one says hi. No one makes eye contact.
And you know why? I'm going to read Eric, who tweeted us. Eric is speaking for me. talk to people on the T. If my daughter's listening, don't do this. I don't care how happy it makes you.
Well, okay.
What a great line.
So why are we so cold about this in big cities in the Northeast?
I think, again, it partly is this mistake that we make of the worst case scenario. And I also think compared to a small town, there's so many people. So you don't have time to chat with every single person you walk by in everyday life. And then you think, well, why would I talk to any of them? I may as well just keep to myself.
You know, the more I think about this, the more I get into it. I'm thinking about last time I rode a subway in New York City a couple of months ago. And this wasn't an aberration. When I lived in New York City and I took the subway every day, I used to do this. Whenever I saw anybody talking to anybody else, you know what I did? I sat as far away from them. Is this humanly? I mean, that's – in any case, let's go to Melissa from – obviously, I'm the outlier here. Melissa, you're from Rhode Island and you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for the call. Hi.
Hi, I love your show.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Jim, yeah. I grew up in New York City, and so I rode public transportation a lot and walking in the street. And growing up in that environment, it was the norm. Like, you don't look at people down the street.
Right.
You walk into a subway, into a train car, and you look down, and you just, like, and you push with your shoulder to make yourself fit. And so, you know, for a long time, I did not talk to strangers. However, since then, I've moved out of New York City. I moved to a Boston suburb. I lived in Boston suburb. And something changed. And I think it started, people would just strike up a conversation with me, or I would start a conversation or ask a question. And now it's to the point where my husband might see me talking to somebody, and he'll come up to me and, you know, and he's like, oh, who was that? And I was like, I have no idea. I've never met that person before in my life. And he's like, you were talking to them for a long time. And I was like, I know, but they were really nice. I just met them here, and, you know, and
so what do you do, Melissa? You know, if you're like, you're standing outside, wherever, outside a pizza joint, waiting for somebody, and there's another person standing there as well, what do you do? Just say, hi, I'm Melissa. What do you do to strike up a conversation? What do you do?
You know what? It could be like the randomest things. Like, if you're in a restaurant, have you been here before? This is my first time. Do you recommend anything? I mean, my husband rolls his eyes anytime I strike up a conversation. I mean, I wish he could be listening to your show. I'm going to have him listen to it tonight. Because he said, Melissa, why do you always talk to random people? But it's amazing. Like, people just have so much to offer. And then, and I don't know. I feel like it's natural. Also, your guest also mentioned something about cashiers and even stepping up. Trader Joe's, I think they train their cashiers. When you go to Trader Joe's and they check you out, there's not been a single time that the cashier does not strike up a conversation. Like,
that's interesting.
How's your day going?
Yeah.
You know, they'll even comment on something like, have you tried this before? Like, oh, I haven't, you know. What are you up to today?
No, you're totally, Melissa, that was a fabulous call. Thank you. Despite what your husband thinks, thanks for making it.
You know,
how about that, Michael? Do they train? I think she's right.
Absolutely. So Starbucks is famous for training baristas to interact
with
customers. Absolutely. They're supposed to learn your drink. You walk in, they know your name because they've written it on the cup, and it feels like it's part of the family now. They absolutely train baristas to interact. And this research says that what we're doing wrong is we're not interacting back. We shouldn't just let them ask these questions. We should ask them back, how's your day as well?
So you have to go. We're going to continue with this, by the way. We take your calls because I am fascinated by this topic. Before you go, there is a moral to the story, as there is with everything you write. Well, give us a 30-second moral, Michael Norton, if you can.
You know, I think that we're so obsessed with avoiding possible badness in our lives and sticking to ourselves and what we know. It's very familiar. It's very comfortable. My commute will be predictable if I just do the thing I do every day. And it just feels like if I do something different, especially if I talk to someone, who knows what's going to happen? I'm going to end up with being robbed or something like that. And this research really shows that, of course, those things can happen. And, of course, it's fine to do business as usual. But we can do these little tiny 1-minute, 2-minute interactions, as the last caller said. They make the other person happy. They make us happy. Maybe they infuriate our partners. But they really do seem to spread a little bit of happiness.
Let me tell you something. After talking to you here and reading your piece, in the distant future, I'm actually going to try this eventually. Michael, I want to...
Great.
Michael Norton, it's great to see you, as always.
Thank you very much, Michael Norton, a behavioral economist at Harvard Business School, the co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, which is a great book. Thanks for being here. We're going to keep taking your calls, though, as Jim said, at 877-301-8970 or BPR at WGBH.org.
Do you talk to people? Didn't you take the train to New York? I think you went somewhere a couple of months ago.
I just went to Ireland.
I know.
But you're sitting next to your friend.
Were people all friendly?
They were unbelievably friendly. I mean, if you stop and ask someone directions in Boston or in New York, you might get a quick, you know, three blocks down, two blocks over, and half the time, I think they just tell you the wrong way.
Intentionally, exactly.
Sometimes I think that. But there, they were going on and on, these elaborate directions and do this and follow that. So I was stunned at how nice and friendly everybody was.
So that's a setting where you walked into an environment where everybody else was doing it and you get caught up in it. Do you, if you're taking a train or riding a bus, do you talk to the person next to you like Michael's doing?
No one sits next to me.
And why is that? Do you have the same – is it through fear?
Because I'm afraid they're going to talk to me all the way to New York City.
This is exactly –
and I have my book or my work.
You want the solitude, right?
Yeah. Now, if the guy from Mad Men sent down next to you, that would be a different story. Like the guy on the airplane, I think most of us might make an exception.
One of the great scenes ever.
Yeah. But I think for the most part, you don't really want to get – or an airplane if you're flying.
Yeah, but you know what Michael Norton, who you respect a lot, suggests? That your life is going to be, in a small way, going to be better and happier, as will that other person. In any case, 877-301-8970. We're going to spend more time with you because this is something that everybody experiences. Let's go to Bill, who is calling from Milford. Bill, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
You will recognize my accent because you have it in the past.
Oh, you're a Philly boy.
Yeah.
I knew it right away. Go ahead.
Isn't that funny? It's weird when you move away how quick you can catch it.
Like, you can.
Dang.
And by the way, a lot of other people who didn't grow up in Philly or southern New Jersey don't even hear it. But if you were there, you know it when you leave the neighborhood.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Bill.
And it might even be something for a conversation starter when you're traveling. I was once known of another friend, Bill, and I were actually – I'm so engaging in my travels that we were known as the talkers. We found this out later. We used to have lunch at the – the art school in Philadelphia, Fine Arts, right?
Yep.
And they had this little cafe, and we'd go in there, and the art students would run it, and we'd have these conversations. And then later, like after we weren't down there anymore, we heard, you know, through the grapevine, oh, you guys were the talkers, Santa Claus.
And what motivates you, the two Bills, Bill? Why do you do that?
Oh, I don't know. It must be the name Bill or something. The Wilhelm, you know, good helmet, you know, a good leader. I think that's what the name means. But at any rate, I used to take the train a lot in town, and I used to ride my bike in town. And actually, both of those are very social and so different from being in a car. And I think a lot of this whole problem has to do with automobile and kind of, and maybe in the Midwest, at least they know, well, when I'm out of the car, I'll talk. But, you know, you actually make eye contact with people on a bicycle, and you have to interact with
people. Yeah, that's a good point.
And you don't in a car. Like a car, you're insulated. And in the train, my God, I made so many friends on the train. I'm sure I made a few enemies too, because like the talking thing.
Yeah, I can hear happiness in your voice. Obviously, what Michael says has worked for you and the other Bill, and thanks so much for your call.
Well, it doesn't always end up so well. Michelle just emailed and said, you know, a funny story a few years ago. She's riding on the Blue Line, an old man sitting beside me. He was inebriated. But he started talking to her, and he was harmless, and she didn't see a problem until, after a few minutes, he reached for her cheek and told her she reminded him of his dead wife. And that was that didn't end that
line
well.
The book. By the way, a friend of mine texted, and I should read it, and she says, I hate talking to anybody. I'd rather fly on a plane full of pit bulls. 877. I mean, he is who he is, and I am who I am. Even though I am going to try it, a la Michael Norton. 877-301-8970.
Listen to this. This is from Jackie. She said she made a final project for her photography class by photographing everyone I met as service people who were behind a counter. So she went around, took pictures of all these people. So it was a fabulous experience, elevated the experiences. Now she's planning to do it for a year.
Yeah, but see that
and have an exhibit.
No disrespect intended to for Jackie, but that is not only aberrational. It's like a non-normal interaction. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's one thing to take a picture of somebody, as odd as that is, but it's another thing to just strike up a conversation with somebody. I just can't. And I am like you. I mean, I like the isolation. I like the solitude. You apparently for good reasons. I for not so good. Anne in Shrewsbury, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks so much for your call. Hi.
Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
I laughed when I heard the topic. I'm a native New Englander in my 50s. Met my soul sister about 10 years ago. We've been really good friends. She's from Oregon. We do not get through a Target line. We don't sit for a cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts without her address. First of all, finding out the person who's helping her name, addressing them by name for the whole transaction. And often, by the time we leave there, I know more about them than I know about my family. She's unbelievable. I mean, she's the sweetest person. And she said, this is how it is in Oregon. That's everybody's friends, everybody's pals. And she said, you know, you're so New England. So I started doing it. My husband he looks at me and laughs. He's like, I can't believe you. I'm, you know, what's your name? How you doing? Thanks a lot. You're doing a great job. It just, people respond. And I've spent 46 years, you know, ignoring the next guy in the train.
It sounds like you're loving the new life, though, are you?
It's awesome. People are.
Listen to you. You're
awesome.
Ecstatic. It's wonderful.
Hey, that was great, yeah. Anne. And by the way, the beauty of Anne is a convert. So it isn't like she's been doing this her whole life, in which case you get sort of a biased analysis. Here's somebody who was more like me and now has become more like Michael Norton.
You know, we are out of time. I'm sorry I didn't get to everybody, but a woman that was just going to call said that she walks her dog and talks to strangers all the time. I think I'm going to stop doing what I usually do, which is catch up on my phone calls while I'm walking the dog. When people come up to me,
that's usually when you call me, actually.
It is. I do a lot of phone calling when I'm walking the dog. But I'm going to stop, Jim, so I can
have interactions
with my fellow human beings on Beacon Street.
By the way, you can read his great Hello, Stranger was the piece that Michael Norton wrote in the New York Times. Google it. It's great.
It's a terrific piece, and his book is Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. That, of course, is Michael Norton, who was with us earlier from the Harvard Business School. Up next, Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory. He's going to recall his days as a White House correspondent when the Lewinsky scandal broke out. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Telemedicine brings together distant patients and doctors. One resistant specialty, psychiatry.
There is a sense that of all the specialties, psychiatry is the one where reach out and touch a patient would make the most sense.
But where psychiatrists are few and far between, telepsychiatry is getting a test run. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Castle Group, PR, digital media, and events partner to businesses that value local connections, international reach, and marketing intelligence, connecting Castle clients with their audiences for 17 years. TheCastleGRP.com. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at harvardvanguard.org and experience better care for a better life.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And joining us, as he does every Wednesday, except for the last two, of course, is the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Welcome back, Brian. Hi.
Thank you, Jim. How are you?
Great.
Good morning.
Marjorie.
Good morning, Brian McGrory. Glad you're well. So let's start, Brian, with this devastating spotlight team piece you've had in the Globe this week about these rat trap college student apartments. The story on Sunday, the first one, talked about a young woman, Bidlin Lee, who was killed in one of these Austin apartments when she was trapped in the third floor with one egress, one exit in this massive fire. Tell us about this series.
Well, I appreciate you bringing it up, Marjorie. And even worse than rat traps, as you point out, there are also fire traps on this one street in that neighborhood, Linden Street. There were two fires right across the street from each other, 84 and 87 Linden Street, a year apart. And Bidlin Lee, described by everybody as an incredibly personable and unbelievably promising Boston University student, died in the attic bedroom because her only exit from the room was through smoke, heavy smoke and fire. And all her other housemates and their guests that night, I think there might have been 13 people in the house that night, all got out except for Bidlin. And so the Globe, our spotlight team, Tom Farragher, is the editor there, did an amazing job with this. They took a nine-month look at the violations in apartments for off-campus students across the city. And what they found was, quite simply, that colleges are growing, our universities are growing in terms of the size of their student bodies, but they are not building the dormitories to house these students. So more and more of these students end up off campus, and they are being preyed upon by landlords who run woefully, rent out woefully substandard apartments, and the city is unable to properly monitor this. And the result is kids are living in squalid and often dangerous conditions, and entire once stable neighborhoods are being completely transformed for the worse because you've got street after street of these you know terrible apartment houses for students, which ironically sell for enormous amounts of money because of the rent they can bring in.
You know, we're talking to Brian McGorriott of the Boston Globe. They're referred to as college rental ghettos, which they really are. I know I'm the prince of hyperbole, but I have rarely read a story where there are more people and more institutions to blame. The city, by its own admission, the law says it's got to inspect a rental apartment every time there's turnover. So they estimate conservatively, says the Globe, they should be doing 44,000 of these inspections a year. Last year they did 2,400, about 1/20th as much. The universities expand, take more students, and then make callous comments like Jack Dunn, the BC spokesman. It cannot be said that those units that may have more than four students living together to meet the high cost of rent will result in the endangerment of students. Not only are they dying, but it's illegal to rent to more than four students for the same place. The landlords are corrupt, if not criminal, in some cases. Where does the buck stop, Brian McGorriott?
Well, you raise a great point. I mean, this was a big, complicated series that we did. And again, Farragher did amazing work. The Spotlight team, Jen Abelson, Jonathan Saltzman, they got a heavy, heavy assist from investigative reporter Todd Wallach, who was terrific with data. Real estate reporter Casey Ross, who played a big role in this series, and editor Mark Morrow, deputy managing editor Mark Morrow, who did just fantastic work editing it. It was unwieldy. Every time you turned around, there's a new target here. And look at, you know, I know colleges are complicit in this, and it was never more apparent than when we learned that Northeastern University was essentially partnered with Anwar Faisal, perhaps the biggest landlord in the city of these kinds of apartments, where they were actually giving Faisal money to renovate some of his apartments to house Northeastern kids in the same building, same block, where Faisal was housing other Northeastern students in squalid apartments.
And by the way, the guy has been convicted, in addition to having these apartments, which are substandard across the board, already convicted of mortgage fraud.
But, you know, the thing that drove me crazy about this guy was that there were all these criminal complaints and lawsuits and code enforcement tickets, and yet he was still allowed to rent. He is still allowed to rent apartments to these kids, and you think of the parents. There was a Berkeley bunch of kids from Berkeley, also with this same Anwar Faisal guy, coming in and you know talking about the smoke detectors dangling down the gaping holes. No one's doing anything about this guy. His tickets are like peanuts, a few thousand bucks.
Nobody is doing anything. The schools, specifically Northeastern, are partnering with them. The city is giving him, you know, benevolent treatment. There was a court decision a while back that essentially said that city building code shouldn't be used punitively. They should be used to change things. So their power to really crack down on someone like Faisal is questionable to begin with. But this has a feeling that everybody is complicit. And I want to make clear, we've just completed this Spotlight series, but we've just begun on this issue. This launches us on this issue. So we are staying with this for a while now. I mean, it's... I don't mean to get angry on the air, but when everybody likes John Tobin over at Northeastern, but when he is out there saying that he has no idea that Faisal is this kind of landlord, when Jack Dunn is over, everybody likes Jack Dunn. He's a terrific guy. Yeah. when he's over at Boston College saying that they don't believe their kids are in any sort of danger or living in squalid conditions over in these houses. Come on, guys. Come on. This is not right.
Well, you know, speaking of universities, and we often talk about how much they charge students, it seems to me that the least the legislature can do here, I don't know if the city council could do it, but the legislature could do, is some sort of legislation that requires that if you accept a student, you have the ability to house a student safely, either in a dorm on campus, maybe they have to build more dorms, a higher percentage of their students, or you have to certify and then be held liable if an off-campus apartment doesn't meet certain standards. I mean, for people who have not read this series, and by the way, it is War and Peace-like. It is really long, but it is worthwhile. This is not just bad. These
disgusting.
Are fire traps. They're horrible
bed
safety
bugs.
Violations. Holes in the floors. It is a real
mold
doors that
in the
don't
showers.
Work.
The video, by the way, I'm not usually a big fan of videos, but the video that went along with this story, Brian, where you see the kid try to open the window and the window falls out in his hands and you see the holes in the wall. And by the way, my son is at Fordham, which is in the Bronx, which is not exactly a great neighborhood living off campus. But this is not a universal thing because at least in his situation, Fordham, they're private landlords, but they're great apartments and they're half the price of these ripoff apartments. This one of these Faisal apartments was $3,800 a month.
Yeah, the apartments are unbelievably expensive. And as you know, they're creating, just to make more money, they're creating bedrooms out of things that never should be bedrooms.
Basements.
In Binlan Lee's situation, an attic, often in basements, living rooms, dining rooms turned into bedrooms. It's extraordinary. That video, by the way, I agree, was
great.
Utterly terrific. It's more like a mini documentary on the whole series. If I would urge people to read the series. It's a really important series. But I'd also advise that people click on the video. It's on our homepage. It was done by Scott LaPierre, who's a world-class videographer for the Globe.
Hey, Brian, I made a snide remark a minute ago that you were kind enough to ignore about the length of this, but it's so important. Do you guys I assume you do in the new digital era. Do you know how many people, for example, clicked on this thing and read it? And do you have that kind of information?
I don't, because I've been on the phone with you, I don't have it in the last 3 minutes. But yes, we do keep extremely careful track.
And how well read is this thing?
The series has been the most read series on our site for the last 3 days. It's extremely well read. What we find, and it's really encouraging, is that when we produce investigative and accountability reporting, stories, journalism, our readership just eats it up.
Great.
This is the part of the Globe that's most valued, and it's the most important thing that we do.
Well, can you imagine the parents of the Northeastern kids and the Berkeley kids and the BU kids and the Boston College kids that are paying $60,000 a year, and they get a little bit less because they're not in on-campus housing, seeing this story? I mean, imagine.
I had Jonathan Solzman on last night, one of the people from the Spotlight team, and I was about to ask the question, but he made the point you did. If you're a parent of a kid who's about to move off campus, what do you do? And there is that. What do you do? There's only a limited universe of available spots, and I assume the answer is you just have to put pressure on the university. That's got to be the focus, I would assume, if you're paying them $60,000 a year.
What's really frustrating is this is what we do in Boston. We are, as the story points out, we're the college capital in the country. We can't treat these kids the way they deserve to be treated. We can't respect the parents' money the way it deserves to be respected when they're spending good money to house their kids. They trust our city to send their kids. They're proud of it, whether they're in California or Des Moines or wherever, and they're sending their kids off here, and we're essentially abusing them the minute they walk through the door of these squalid apartments. You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, and the Attorney General has let this guy Faisal off the hook too. So it's not just the inspectional services in Boston. This is a state.
It's everybody.
It's everybody.
It's at every level.
Well, all we can say is go read it. If you didn't buy it, if you didn't buy the paper, go online and read it and watch the videos. It's really powerful stuff. Hey, Brian, we wanted to talk to you about a couple of public officials who may have crossed the line and stuff that's been reported in your paper. This morning, there's a story about Steve Crosby, the same Steve Crosby who's chair of the Gaming Commission, who Marty Walsh wants to recuse himself from any decision in eastern Massachusetts, the same Steve Crosby didn't disclose for a long period of time that he actually had a connection to somebody who's involved in the Everett process, on and on like this. Mass gambling official attended Suffolk Downs party, presence while racetrack pursues casino question. We have the former Inspector General, Greg Sullivan, former state rep too, says it's wholly inappropriate. It's no different than I'm reading from the Globe, than a judge attending an opulent bash thrown by one of the parties in a legal case he's presiding over without asking you to cross the line. Isn't that a fair characterization when we're potentially weeks, if not months, away from the awarding of a casino and Suffolk Downs is one of the two bidders?
Marjorie, don't you love the way Jim says, I'm not asking you to cross the line, and then invites me across
that's
the
right.
line?
That's right. He does it every week, Brian. And, I have noticed. It's disgraceful.
You know, I'm like the big, dumb Labrador that's now running toward the line, saying, I'm going to get that tennis ball that he's holding. You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So what was your reaction when you read the story by Andrea Estes? And was it Mark? How do you say his last name?
Arsenault. He's a world-class reporter, and this was a great, great story. And Andrea Estes, obviously,
great.
Too, was one of the great investigative reporters in the country.
She's terrific.
Here's what I'll say. The story was on the front page, so we made a decision about the importance of this story by where we placed it. So obviously, I think it's an important thing for people to know. I will confess that at this sensitive stage of the gambling debate and at a time when decisions, we're on the eve of decisions here.
Yeah.
And there are two major players, Wynn and Suffolk Downs with Mohegan Sun. These decisions are being made now. They're being worked out now. Steve Crosby has been under scrutiny for some of his prior relationships. And I'm going to barrel across the line a little bit here and just say I'm a little bit surprised that he would choose to do this. I would just think he would want to be so far away from any of these issues that, he would go to great lengths to not have to read a story like this in the Morning Globe.
Well, that's what stunned me. I was more than surprised. I was totally stunned because I know lots of people have great respect for Steve Crosby. I've met him a few times, gone to a couple of these gambling commission meetings and stuff. Really smart guy. He's been around for a long time. My reaction was, what the heck was he thinking?
Mine too.
Even though he paid his $400 or whatever it cost
that's
to go to
the
Suffolk. Well, I'm just pointing that out. He did pay for his ticket. But it's crazy.
Here's what bothered me, Marjorie. I'm sorry I interrupted.
That's okay.
But,
I'm used to it.
here's what bothered me is when his spokeswoman over at the Gaming Commission said that, this is part of what they do for in his role as racing commissioner, which he also is when he has the Gaming Commission. But then you read in the story that he took his wife. There were, quote-unquote family members in addition. So this obviously wasn't a strictly official visit to the racetrack on opening day and the day of the Kentucky Derby. It was a surprising display of his judgment here, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, speaking of leaving it at that, since you mentioned a spokeswoman, let's raise another spokeswoman in one of my other favorite stories in the Globe this week about oysters. There is a story that put us both over the edge. There was a story in the Boston Globe about this guy who's trying to do a local oyster farm in Mashpee. Well, it turns out slipped into the House budget by a legislator who does not represent the Cape.
Jim. What? It was slipped into the House budget in the wee hours.
In the wee hours, exactly.
Late in the night.
Slipped in was this thing that essentially precludes this guy from having an oyster farm. They don't use the names of the locations. They use the GPS coordinates so that no one will know.
Well, you do that too.
I would, exactly. The state rep, we spoke to Dan Wolf, the senator who represents the area yesterday. He obviously knew nothing about this. But my favorite part of the story, and it always is, Marjorie knows this, is when the Globe reporter Jim O'Sullivan calls Robin Glazer, who happens to be the spokesperson for the Kraft Group, because two of the people who have large homes on this particular place are Robert Kraft and his son, Jonathan. She tells him to call somebody else and then hangs up on the Globe reporter. And then when the Globe reporter Jim O'Sullivan calls the other person, they never return. his phone call. You've been in around the legislature for a long time. Pam Wilmot from Common Cause said to us yesterday, before we spoke to Dan Wolf, there's less of this than there used to be. But what was your reaction to this thing that you also, I think, put on the front page, at least front page Metro somewhere? What was your reaction to this?
Well, you just gave my reaction to it. I put it on the front page. You know? I'm going to get out of the way while you guys compliment the Globe today. I mean, what do you need me for?
We've had a lot of good stories this week, Brian McGroy.
I don't know why it is, and obviously you should be more perturbed about it than I am. When someone has the audacity to hang up on a reporter in the middle of a totally legitimate set of questions, it totally puts me over the edge. It is unbelievable. It's also unbelievable they continue to do this kind of thing.
May put you over the edge, Jim, but I mean, don't you realize that what we get at the Globe, what you get on the radio, is the ability to tell people that they hung up on the reporter.
Yeah, that's true.
And to put that, you know, on the air or in print, and to let people judge for themselves the kind of behavior that we're dealing with. I actually find it more amusing than, anything to be angry about.
Yeah.
It's a healthy attitude.
I guess they didn't want to ruin the views down there with those little oyster beds. So I'm not sure how they're going to ruin the views.
By the way, they can lobby all they want. Do it in the light of day. Don't hide it. If you want to put the bill in, fine. Let's have it. Whatever. Go ahead.
So Brian, you were a White House correspondent in the days of Monica Lewinsky, correct?
I was. I was down there from 96 to 98. I was there when the whole Monica story broke.
Well, the reason we mentioned, of course, is she's got a new piece out in Vanity Fair when she's talking about her affair with the president. And, you know, I wonder, does this impact anything? I mean, can it possibly hurt Hillary? Why do this now? She's 40 years old. I'm not sure if I'm Monica Lewinsky, I want to go there yet again. But what do you make of it?
Yeah, I don't know what I don't have my head fully around it, and I really need to read the whole story. We all saw the excerpts in the blurbs on it. I don't know. Everyone, the conventional wisdom is that it hurts Hillary. I'm not sure if it really does. This is coming out pretty early in the process. I think it goes away in a month. I think people kind of see it for what it is. So I'm not convinced this is in any way durably harmful to Hillary. I assume probably think the opposite.
I don't think it's hurtful. I think it's hurtful to Monica Lewinsky. Actually, it's continuing hurt to Monica Lewinsky, who's never really got her life on track. But she was. What I think is interesting in this piece is she talks about how she was suicidally depressed because she was so humiliated.
Well, she couldn't get a job. She was. I think her reaction is fairly understandable.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah, yes.
I do. Although I will tell you, and yes, I mean you are. There was a while that she was probably the most familiar name in the world.
Right.
I mean, everybody, and not in a good way. Although, I ever tell you my legal seafood Monica Lewinsky story?
No, please do.
Go ahead.
So, it was a few weeks after the story broke. Legal Seafood opened a restaurant in Washington, I think on K Street. I get a call one night from, let's just say, an executive from Legal Seafood, saying that they had, I don't know why they did this, they offered Monica a free dinner anytime she wanted to come in and have dinner at Legal Seafood, and that she would be there at X hour, and that perhaps I might want to be in the restaurant if I wanted to see her. And I just started laughing, and I said, well, you know, how close can I get? And the person on the other end of the line said, well, how about the next table?
Oh, and my God.
So I go over to the legal, and I was sat at a couple of tables away, and I watched her eat basically with her lawyer the right side of the menu for free. And
side of the menu.
It was, I'm sure it was an official or, you know, a billable legal visit or consultation, but they were there for hours. I mean, hours, talking and eating. And I have no doubt that she was depressed and suicidal, but it was interesting to see her very much out and about in Washington just a few weeks after all this blew up.
You know, when I hear about her, I always think of Meghan Marshak. Remember Meghan Marshak? She was found, well, she wasn't found, but Nelson Rockefeller was found dead after they'd been having a liaison in her apartment. And then she, after putting his pants on backwards, she just disappeared. you know, she just disappeared. And we presume she went on to have some sort of decent life.
Yeah, but how long after that did Nelson Rockefeller die? It wasn't long, was it?
He died in her apartment.
Well, right, exactly. So
in the mist, in flagrante,
Bill Clinton not only didn't die, he's arguably the highest profile politician other than Barack Obama in the world. So it's a little different context.
It's a little different, but I still think it might have been wise for her just to kind of disappear.
You know, in defense of Monica Lewinsky, can we agree the single best shrimp cocktail in the world at Legal Seafood? Can you agree with that, Brian?
Yeah. I do agree with that. I do agree. And listen, the reality is you can't help but have sympathy for her.
Oh,
totally.
Forever ruined here. It's a terrible, terrible thing.
It is a terrible.
One last thing, Brian.
One last thing about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We're going to play you a little bit of sound, our favorite bit of sound from the Correspondents' Dinner last weekend.
As a general rule, things don't end well if the sentence starts, "Let me tell you something I know about the Negro." You don't really need to hear the rest of it.
Now, Brian, I just want to know, in your years as a columnist at the Boston Globe, did you ever begin a column with, "Let me tell you something I know about the Negro," and go on from there? You ever use that opening line?
Did you guys watch the whole act on that dinner?
As long as you don't tell anybody, the answer is yes.
I was out of the country, so I missed it.
Did you?
I'm probably embarrassed to say I did. I mean, I've been to – have you been to the dinner before?
Nope.
I've been to more than my share. It's, from my money, the worst dinner in Washington. I mean, you've got 3,000 people there, and all of them dressed as waiters in black tie, lockover waiters. And it's an awful mix of Hollywood celebrities and Washington reporters and wannabes, and I will tell you, I always found it to be a pretty unpleasant night.
Should it go the same way as Brian McGorry thinks that South Boston St. Patrick's Day breakfast should go?
You know, they're not that far off.
That's what I
thought. Who is the main comedian?
Joel McHale.
Yeah.
I thought he was exquisitely mediocre.
Yeah, he so got trashed. People. He got panned.
But Obama was pretty great, was he not?
Obama was good. Was very good. Yeah, yeah.
He's got great timing. For a president of the United States, he's got great comedic timing, I'd say.
He does. What did you make of the Joe Biden film, though? Did you see this?
Jim thought it was very funny.
I thought that Julia Louis-Dreyfus's imitation of Kevin Spacey on House of Cards, which you probably don't even watch, was the highlight of the whole evening. You thought it was low rent?
Oh, my God. I thought it was indecipherable. I didn't think there was a single laugh line in the whole film.
Good to talk to you, Brian. Brian McGorry, editor of the Boston Globe.
Thanks,
talk to you next week,
Brian, for being with us, as always. Brian McGorry is the editor of the Boston Globe, and he joins us every Wednesday. Up next, Charlie Sennett from Global Post joins us to go over some of the major stories around the world, from the mass kidnappings in Nigeria to international outrage at the United States over our death penalty. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
is a keystone, the key to America's next steps in confronting climate change.
We talk all the time about energy independence and how great that is. It's not a pretty sight when you see it up close.
A new report says climate change is not a pretty sight anywhere in America. The fate of the Keystone Pipeline and a Congress divided on energy and the environment. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Cambridge Savings Bank, a proud member of the community for over 175 years, providing a full range of financial products for individuals, families, and businesses. Because legacy matters. CambridgeSavingsBank.com. And Innuendo in Natick, presenting the Hunter Douglas Celebration of Light Window Fashions event, featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella, Silhouette, and Vignette Shading Systems, available with Light Rise Cordless Upgrade. Innuendo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And after last week's botched execution in Oklahoma, is it time for the U.S. to do some serious soul-searching about the death penalty? Europe says it is, and they're pressuring from overseas for us to kick the habit. And in Nigeria, as you know, a mass kidnapping of schoolgirls has finally gotten the attention from leaders across the world, including ours. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on these and other international headlines is the man Marjorie called Charles Sennett early this morning.
I did.
Charles is the vice president and founder of Global Post. Charlie, it's good to see you.
Thanks, Jim. Good to see you. Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you very much.
I don't know what got into me.
39 again.
39. Exactly. That's right. We're going to stay 39 forever here in this studio. Anyway, this has been just one of the most upsetting stories. The kidnapping of these 300 schoolgirls in Nigeria by this Islamic terrorist organization. Today we read that they've attacked and killed another 125 people in northeast Nigeria. So what is going on with this Boko Haram? I hope I pronounced it correctly.
So we've just recently done a special report on Global Post on Nigeria, on the Christian-Muslim divide. And I was there for a couple of weeks, and we published this report in February. And I have to say, I've covered a lot of different permutations of al-Qaeda around the world, and I've looked at Islamic extremism, the clash between Christians and Muslims. I'm with you on this. I had no idea how deep, profound, and complex the situation in Nigeria is between the Christians who are to the south and the Muslims who are to the north. The fault line where this really insurgency, this war is happening, is in the northeast of Nigeria. So when you say, what is happening there, I think all of us feel that way. Like, where did this explosion of violence come from? It's really important to set the context that this is a 15-year-old insurgency met with a really aggressive counterinsurgency in the last 5 years by the Nigerian military. 20,000 people have been killed in 15 years in Nigeria. There are bombings frequently. There are villages that explode in this interreligious violence, right? So you get Christian neighborhoods and Muslim neighborhoods suddenly just explode in these rumors, and then they start to attack each other. So there's a lot of bloodshed, a lot of violence, a lot of context that we don't have. But
why schoolgirls? I mean, that's the part that I know there's a lot of violence in the world, all of which is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I think has shocked the world, not that everything else shouldn't, is these kids, these schoolgirls in the hundreds. Why that? Why did they decide? Because they knew they'd get headlines? Why that as a target?
So the group that actually carried out these kidnappings of the girls is called Boko Haram. And that translates, it's a mix of the local language in Nigeria, but also with the local dialect in Nigeria, but also Arabic. So Boko really means Western education. And haram is Arabic for blasphemy or sin. So it means basically Boko Haram, this terrorist group, the title of the group is Western education is a sin. These girls were perceived as being educated with Western influences, which Boko Haram, in its warped interpretation of the Quran, sees as a sin, as blasphemy, which they need to then rescue these girls by going in and kidnapping them and turning them over into what is essentially slavery. This is so horrific, so far beyond the pale, even for the level of violence we've seen in Nigeria. It's very interesting to watch Nigeria itself reacting to this.
Slowly, if at all. What are they doing?
The president, Goodluck Jonathan, reacted ridiculously slowly. You're absolutely right. They did nothing at first. They were very slow. Indifferent probably wouldn't be a bad word to use. The Nigerian people have reacted very strongly. So you're seeing now a disconnect between the government in Abuja, which is trying very hard to say, you know, we're all over this. But everyone knows that's not true. You haven't really paid attention to this, and you haven't paid attention to the insurgency, which is exploding all around us. So I think that this presidency of Goodluck Jonathan is in trouble. I think this is a real political issue now. And, of course, they are hosting today the World Economic Forum. So Africa sits on the possibility of having a really intense increase in its economy. There's a lot of vibrancy. There's a lot of possibility for Africa to emerge as an economic stronghold in the coming years. It's already there. They're building a middle class. There's a big economic story there, which is, of course, completely overshadowed by the militancy and the violence. And it raises questions about who would want to invest in a place like Nigeria when you can't even really achieve stability or safety for the people.
So the Nigerian government has been slow, but I think it's fair to say so is the rest of the world. Here's President Obama finally talking about the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls.
Well, we're sending in a team made up of our military and law enforcement and other experts, and we're very glad that Nigeria's accepted the help. Obviously, what's happening is awful, and as the father of two girls, I can't imagine what the parents are going through.
Where has the world been? What took so long attempt to come to the rescue of kids who were being – go ahead.
Well, before you even get there, I just wondered, Charlie Sennett from Global Post, is it possible for the Nigerian military to find these young girls if they want to, or is this too difficult? I mean –
it certainly should be. I mean, this is the most populous nation in Africa. This is a country with great oil wealth, with a very powerful, large military, and they should have not allowed these men to come into a school, take 300 girls. They're separate. They're two different episodes here. And by the way, this has happened before in the past. This is not the first time.
What do you mean? The kidnapping of
kidnapping
girls?
Of girls has happened in years past.
In Nigeria.
So we haven't been paying attention, Jim. You're absolutely right. How could the military not have these guys? Very fair question. And I think it's, as I say, the question that the Nigerian country is asking of its government. What are you doing? To see the White House respond to this is interesting. And I think potentially... I don't want to say perilous, but certainly curious and potentially could go bad.
Why?
If we can't get them, then we're going to really look bad there. So they've put in this very small unit, military unit, law enforcement, presumably FBI, and intelligence assets, presumably CIA. They're trying to build a sort of hub, as Secretary of State Kerry put it, for intelligence to go after these guys. But now they've been gone so long. And they're believed to be holding these girls in a series of camps, which are heavily armed, moving them at night. You're now really into a thicket of that insurgency. And I think this may have been the strategy of Boko Haram, was to try to invite the West in and say, we are going to liberate, and that's in huge quotes, liberate these girls, meaning abduct them and put them up for forced marriage. And as they've said publicly, sell them into slavery.
Yeah.
So this is an invitation to the conflict that America seems to have accepted. Now, how could we not do anything is a fair question. How do you stand by on an injustice like that and not help? On the other hand, we are entering a very complex insurgency that we need to be hyper aware of. So, Marjorie, this morning over coffee, you were saying like Nigeria and this is intimidating. I wanted to try something here, which is to take the front page story of the Boston Globe about climate change.
Yep.
And tell you why that has everything to do with what's happening in Nigeria. I know that sounds
like
a stretch.
Go right ahead.
But we tried to bring it home, right? So here's what's happening. In northern Nigeria, where the Muslim population is predominant, they are pastoralists historically. That means they graze their cattle. Their cattle moves all over the countryside up there. But the Sahel is drying up, and it's forcing them north. They're migrating north. As they migrate north, they hit the Christian predominant south, where they are farmers, fixed farmers on land, where they graze their cattle on a farm with fences. That has a lot to do with this clash. It has as much to do with it as religion. So the climate change forces the migration of the Muslims from the north down to clash with the south.
Yeah.
And it really is not a stretch to say you have to understand how that has impacted this crisis and this problem of violence. And a very small footnote to the kidnapping of the girls. If you read the fine news stories in the Nigerian press, they point out that the kidnappers also took livestock. So what you have are pastoralist farmers moving to the south, stealing cattle and girls, and it is absolutely connected with this migration of related to climate. So I think we think of these things as these foreign issues that we can't understand, and yet right on the front page of the Globe is this very important series on the impact of climate change in our environment here in Boston. It ripples through the world, and it expresses itself in ways that we're not thinking about, but that we need to think about.
Well, let's do another story where the world is interconnected in a big-time kind of way. People have learned about Clayton Lockett, this guy who was sentenced to death in Oklahoma, who committed as atrocious, and I know it's hard to compare, as atrocious a set of crimes as virtually anybody I've ever read about, just grotesque. They attempt to execute him in Oklahoma. People all know the story now. They botched it because of something with the drugs. They stopped after he's writhing in pain for a long period of time. Half hour later, he dies of a heart attack. Not only does that cause Barack Obama to say, I'm going to have my attorney. He supports the death penalty, Barack Obama, in limited cases. Not only does it cause him to say, I'm going to have my attorney general look at this issue, it causes most of Western Europe, where the death penalty has been outlawed, to try to put pressure on the United States in the wake of the Lockett thing, Charlie,
yeah,
to say it's time for you to join the rest of the Western world in banning the death penalty. Does anybody in Washington care what any of our allies in Western Europe think about the death penalty in the United States?
They don't seem to, and they probably won't until more Americans start to think about what kind of company we keep when we carry out the death penalty. We're in there with Saudi Arabia, Iran, North Korea.
We're ahead of North Korea and Libya by a lot, by the way. I'm just reading the stats.
I also think this is as some, you know, we talk a lot about the Catholic Church and its role in Boston, it's a very prominent moral force in this city. I'm always stunned by Boston Catholics who don't want to really live up to that part of the whole creed,
yeah,
being against the death penalty, which is part of that fabric of life that the Catholic Church talks about. You know, When you lived in Europe, as I have for 5 years, I lived in London, you look at the United States sometimes as this place that seems just absurd in its logic. And you wonder, how is it that we in America aren't analyzing these things? So when I hear the Europeans begin to criticize us on the death penalty in this and jumping, of course, on this horrific botched case in Oklahoma, we need to listen. We need to pay much closer attention to how we carry ourselves in the world, because it's part of knowing who you are, is to look at yourself in the mirror and have some reflection there, right?
And they have some leverage, because some of the drugs that are causing the sedatives are manufactured in Western Europe. And from what I understand, Western nations are beginning to ban the manufacture or export, which puts the United States in a position that we may have more Clayton Lockett
and
more controversy.
And there are even
perhaps equally important, there are international covenants, conventions, which Europe has constantly pushed forward the idea that the United States has to stop this. And I really think we need to listen. We need to have a much bigger debate. We're going to have one right here in Boston with the Marathon bombing case.
Yep.
And that will highlight, I think, Boston as a liberal bastion, which may, in a federal court, may carry out an execution. But it's still in Boston, even if it's a federal court. And we are going to have a debate on this, and I think we really should do this in a global context. Look at ourselves in comparison to the world. Think about the company we keep.
You know, I just wonder, Charlie Sennett, because you are from Global Post and have spent a lot of time all around the world. I wonder what you think. There's a certain resentment in the United States of America to listening to what anybody thinks. Why do we – oh, the Brits, you know, the French, the Spanish people. You know, there's a resentment, and it doesn't seem to go the other way. I mean, what – you know, I'm sure that people read these stories about they're criticizing us for the death penalty and say, so what? It bothers me, but I'm not sure that sentiment is very
your average
widespread.
Oklahoman is offended that a guy with a French accent has a problem with the death penalty.
I don't think you have to travel to Oklahoma, by the way. I think there is that notion that we are the most important most powerful, most moral country on the planet.
Most moral.
And no, I'm but I think that is the attitude. I think the notion is we don't want anybody telling us what to do about anything. I think it's fairly widespread, no?
I think we all know it is. I mean, for sure it's widespread. It's widespread in this Commonwealth as much as it is around the country. But certainly the death penalty, like the issue of abortion, it's the third rail. It's an electric argument that goes through politics, and it courses across Democrat and Republican. It's very complicated. But I do think the job of us at Global Post, for all of us as journalists, is to get us to think about ourselves in a context in which maybe we start to ask some hard questions, like how do you square being Catholic with allowing the death penalty?
Well, I should say, by the way, we've had this discussion before. The cardinal laws of the world now, who are reviled for good reasons. Cardinal Law was one of the most outspoken people in his heyday on poor people's issues. Mm-hmm. And
civil
on
rights.
And he was consistent, by the way, is while they were pro-life, mm-hmm. big time, they were pro-life at both ends,
right.
meaning against the death penalty, but it doesn't necessarily trickle down to the rest of the population. But let me follow up on Marjorie's question.
They squandered their moral authority
in
sex abuse crisis.
They did.
And they're going to have a long way to build it back.
And by the way, one interesting thing out of that, which we don't have time to talk about today, my understanding is now that this UN committee is – and we'll get back to this in just one second, mm-hmm. but since you brought up the whole sex abuse issue, since they are now talking about sex abuse in the Catholic Church in the context of torture, potentially the statutes of limitations which have barred prosecutions of priests and bishops may disappear in at least some jurisdictions around the world, which could create a whole different dynamic. But back to this for a second. Mm-hmm. Because we in this country often correctly like telling people who treat other human beings, governments who treat other human beings poorly, we like saying to them, if you don't treat your people better, we're going to have sanctions, we're going to boycott. If we were a non-death penalty country, and I know this is a hypothetical, mm-hmm. how would we treat countries that are allies who have the death penalty? My assumption
we
is
would
we,
say
threaten
we, are
them with we threaten them with sanctions.
Wouldn't
we?
I mean, we'd have moral superiority on that. We
seriously,
would say,
isn't that
how
what happened?
This barbaric thing. No, I think America, you know, as always, is a complex place. And I hate to leave like on a downer note because
it's okay.
America.
So don't leave quite yet, Dan.
America carries itself in the world, sometimes with arrogance, but often with a lot of compassion. Another story in the Globe that I love today is this story on the Ugandan gay rights activist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, there's a story where this city, a beacon of gay rights to the world, invites in someone who's speaking out against a country that wants to have the death penalty. Uganda wants to have the death penalty for people who are homosexual, right? That movement for the death penalty for homosexuality in Uganda was propelled in part by evangelical churches here in the United States who have put funding into that fight in Uganda. And this sort of, it sort of connects with the death penalty argument. Like, we need to know that these forces are at work. We need to understand that the evangelical churches in America are fighting hard for this. And do they have the right to do that in the name of the United States with a tax break and a 501c3 religious code to be
non-profit
funding? That's interesting. And I think we got to think in this global context and be proud of the fact that this activist from Uganda is sitting in a law office in Boston applying for asylum because this place, Boston, this country is still a beacon to the world. And that's the other part of the equation we can't forget.
You know, so it's paradoxical, I guess we'd say.
You know, Charlie Sennett is looking at me. I'm laughing as Charlie Sennett is talking about this guy facing the death penalty. And obviously I'm not laughing at him. I don't know why this came to mind. Was it at Columbia when Ahmadinejad did his thing at Columbia? And he's excoriated
he's insane,
by
right?
the president at the beginning, the president of Columbia. I can't remember his name. At the beginning of the thing.
Bollinger. Lee Bollinger.
Right. From Michigan before, right?
Wasn't he? That's right.
Wasn't that the speech where an answer to a question about how Iran treats homosexuals? Wasn't that where Ahmadinejad said we don't have any homosexuals?
That's right.
Wasn't
that
his position?
Well,
that's an easy way to do it.
Yeah.
So what's coming up on Global Post in the near future, Charlie said?
So Global Post, we have a couple of big things coming. One of the big things we have coming is this series we're doing right now on youth unemployment around the world. So this comes off of our Global Income Inequality series we did.
You guys do terrific work. You really do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So the next phase is called Generation TBD. And it's about young people around the world struggling to find jobs, not just Americans right here in our own backyard who are living in their parents' basement looking for a job. We all know that story.
No.
There are deep stories in Nigeria, for example, this country in the news very much, 70% unemployment for young people. The ages between 15 and 24, they're not in school nor in a job, 70%. So you're dealing with this generation that has taken to some street kids in Lagos have these tattoos that they put on their chest that says born throwaway.
Oh man.
And the despair is out there, but there's also amazing creativity going on in places like Egypt, even in Europe, where young people can't find jobs and they're becoming serious entrepreneurs. So there's the good stories and then there's the really challenging stories, but we're going to look at it all. And we're actually today, Global Post Special Reports, which is under the umbrella of something we call the Ground Truth Project, is now here at GBH, and we're going to be working hopefully more
Terrific.
Closely with you guys.
Love
it. So, and by the way, I hate to correct you on the way out the door since you know what you're talking about. Those kids in America who are sitting in their mother's basements looking for jobs are also emailing the Herald and submitting comments on Marjorie's columns. So they're doing two things at once.
That's
Charlie Sennett, it's great to see you.
Great
Charlie,
to see you guys.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Sennett is the vice president and founder of the fantastic Global Post. Always great to talk to you, Charlie.
Thank you. Co-founder of Global Post.
Co-founder of Global Post, excuse me.
That's okay.
Up next, agonizing over a cheese Danish, an apartment coated in grime, and a wild sale on pantyhose. These are some of the details of cartoonist Roz Kass' new memoirs about her aging parents. She joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, Joanne Berger Sweeney is the fourth black female college president in New England. Is she part of a trend? If you missed it on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Every year, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to land some hot deals, and every winning bid supports the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and M.F. Reynolds, builder since 1890, craftsman and construction manager specialized in residential remodeling projects and historic renovation in Boston and the surrounding areas. Details at mfreynolds.com. And WGBH's Nova. Leading shark experts join with Nova to uncover the science behind the hunting instincts of the great white shark. Don't miss Nova, Why Sharks Attack, tonight at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And it's the moment we've all been waiting for, and we didn't even know we were waiting for it until it happened. And that is Roz Chast's take on aging and dying. Roz Chast, as you know, is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. Her new memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It details the aging and death of her parents. Roz, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we have so enjoyed going through your book. So tell us essentially, we all know you're a cartoonist at The New Yorker, and this is a book of cartoons, but it talks about your parents getting older. Tell us what you've done here.
It's I hope, an interesting book. It was something I really wanted to do. It's a graphic memoir, but it's not a typical graphic memoir. It has a lot of cartoons in it. It has illustrations. It has text, although none of it is set in type. It's written in my own handwriting, and photographs, and then some non-cartoon type drawings at the end. So
Well, you have a lot of very funny stuff at the beginning of the book. Well, all through the book, actually. But at the beginning of the book, and you talk about, you know, your parents and how they got together and how they told you about their horrible lives and so forth that couldn't compete. You were so lucky. Your mother built like a fire hydrant and a peasant, and your father kind of spindly and stuff. But it's a relationship. You're dealing with – well, you talk about trying to talk to them about, you know, their plans.
The talk.
Yes, the talk. How did that go, the talk that you tried to have with your parents?
It didn't really go very well, but I have to say here that I was equally reluctant to have the talk. So we were all complicit in this avoidance of the topic. And I think, you know, why not? Because it is a terrible topic. It's an awful topic. Nobody really wants to talk about it. How do you know when you're ready to take the next step? And I didn't want to push them. I just thought maybe it would be a good idea at some point if we just sort of broached the topic. But it didn't go very well. The title of the book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, actually comes from something my father would say whenever this sort of topic would come up.
And by the way, we should put this in the context then, because I can relate to this as an only child. You're an only child.
Yes.
So,
right.
I mean, the burden falls even more heavily, even though your parents were in their 90s. So it wasn't like you're having a conversation with parents who were in their early 60s or
something like that.
It was clear it was on the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This isn't something, I mean, I've talked to people in their 20s who say, my parents are like 68 or something. And I think, no. That's not what I'm talking about.
You
know, can you put this in? Let's talk about them for a minute before you talk about their end and how you dealt with this. One of the things that appealed to me particularly, I used to be a housing lawyer in the South Bronx, and I dealt with a lot of people who were lived in so-called Collier's mansions.
Oh, yeah.
Your parents were pack rats.
Yes.
They collected and kept everything.
Right.
You photograph it. You draw about it. You write about it. Tell us a little bit about that.
My parents were both born in 1912. Depending on how you count, I always thought, I had heard when I was growing up 10 days apart, but the New Yorker told me it's actually 11 days. So they were both born in 1912. They grew up as children of immigrants, very, very poor. Their parents didn't speak English. And they graduated from college in 1932, I think, into the Depression. And so there were a lot of factors, I think, that combined to make them, you know, almost pathologically frugal. You know, the consumption culture of the United States was something that was very foreign to them. And sometimes, you know, as I said in the book, there are aspects of it that I admired, that I thought were great. You know, you don't want to, I hate the idea of, you know, you have perfectly good silverware and then like, let's just replace it because I'm bored, you know, and it's stupid, but
how about the potholder, though? I mean, tell us about the potholder that you drew
well,
about.
That cartoon I did well before I ever thought about doing this book. I was visiting them. I was living in Connecticut with my family, and my parents were in Brooklyn. And I picked up this oven mitt. And it was so decrepit. It was not only, it was just like the most decrepit oven mitt that I had ever seen. It was like burnt in places. And then I realized it was patched. And it was like my mother sewed patches on an oven mitt. And then I realized that the patches of the oven mitt were made from the fabric I recognized. It was a skirt that I had to make in seventh grade in home ec. And it was just, it was just too much.
We're talking to Roz Chass, the brilliant cartoonist. You've seen her stuff in The New Yorker forever, and she has a new book, which is huge and great. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And the topic that they're not talking about is dying.
Yeah, and for people that haven't seen the book yet, and you should get it because it's fantastic, this is all told with these great cartoons and great pictures of you and your parents with the great special facial expressions looking horrified or aghast, but dealing with something that is so universal. I mean, you talk about when your mother fell and refused to go to the hospital.
Yeah. My mother hated hospitals and, you know, with a somewhat good reason. A lot of old people do go to the hospital and then worse things happen. You know, not everybody. But she was afraid of that. She didn't want doctors. She fell off of a small step stool. And that was sort of the beginning of this more sort of precipitous decline. But what really was going on was not so much the fall off the ladder, which was bad enough, but that she also had diverticulosis, which is sometimes flared up into diverticulitis. And she would have attacks of it. But in the past, she was always able to sort of wait them out. But at that point, soon after the fall, she went into an attack that she wasn't able to fight off.
You know, I'm looking at one of your cartoons. It's just, it is hard to do through the radio, but there is this unbelievable drawing of your mother. And your mother says, hold on a minute while I look for it. This is obviously all for her collection. And then, actually, why don't, do you mind reading it? It's just, it is so perfect. Read your, this is okay. Roz Chass reading a cartoon about her having a phone conversation with her mother.
Well, it needs a little bit of background here. Because it also, in some weird way, I felt that I was at fault here, because the reason she was on this stepladder was because I was telling her in that sort of weirdly braggy way that you do to your parents, even when you are, you should be like well past this and much more mature. I was, for work, going with a friend of mine. She was going to write it. I was going to draw it. We were going to the Galapagos Islands. And in that sort of braggy, like, Mom, look what I am doing kind of way, I told her that I was going. And she said, oh, Daddy and I went to the Galapagos Islands about 30 years ago. And when we crossed the equator, we got a certificate from King Neptune. And I think it's up on top of the crazy closet. Now, the crazy closet was this closet in the middle of our apartment that sort of functioned as our attic, and it held – it was just amazing, all of the crap that was in that closet. It was like every piece of falling apart cheap luggage they had ever had, an old Rexograph machine from my father's, you know, teaching days, stacks of unused, like, French and Spanish exams that he hadn't, like, given out, textbooks, and bathrobes, galoshes, pajamas – hats, everything you could think of, just crammed in there. And the idea of my, I think my mother was 93 at the time, the idea of her getting up on a step stool to find that stupid piece of paper was not something I wanted her to do. So, but she was extremely strong-willed and compulsive. So here's the cartoon. I'm talking to my mother on the phone. I've just told her about this. She's explained to me that she wants to go and get the certificate. And she goes, and this is my mother, hold on a minute while I look for it. And this is me. Mom, please do not look for it. I don't want it. Please do not climb to the top of the crazy closet. Promise me. And she just goes to the phone. She goes, and hangs up. You know,
with a great look on her face, by the way. It's almost a mischievous look, like, that's where I'm going. I am making a beeline to that
closet. I'm doing it. You got another thing coming. If you think that your, like, strong words from up there in Connecticut will have any effect on my not climbing the step stool, you don't know me, Miss Chass.
Well, Roz, Chass,
I just want to say, this is the brilliance of your book, Roz, because, you know, people can write this, but you have the cartoons with the expressions and the whole and the images of your parents and yourself and sitting on these little couches. I mean, it just makes it perfect. It just makes it perfect.
Well, thanks.
So you ultimately get them in a retirement home, and obviously ultimately, and I don't mean this to be cavalier or quick, your parents die. But then where are your parents?
Well, for the time being, my parents, I have no idea where my parents are. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a whole other question, but their cremains, which is a really horrible word, are in my closet at home. I got them. I picked them up from the funeral home, and it's a very strange thing. I mean, you know, we don't have like a little spot on Cape Cod that we always, you know, called our own, where mother always said to me, you know,
When I die,
scatter my ashes on Granny's place. No, you know, we never had that in my family. We didn't talk about death. I did not know what to do with the cremains.
Sounds good to me.
Well, you know, Jim might be able to give you some advice on what to do with the cremains. Why don't you tell
my
Roz
mother
where
is
you are?
My mother's in a box in the back of my car, and she's been there she's relatively near me.
In the trunk.
And she didn't have a place either.
Do you like driving around with her?
I don't think about it much. But occasionally, when I'm sorting through things, I find the box, and you say, your mother is in the back of your car.
See, I like having them in my closet.
Yeah.
Because I like my closet. And it's kind of, I don't mind having them there. And until I figure out a good place, like a place that makes sense, I don't mind. It doesn't. It seems less arbitrary than any other place I can.
How do you
of.
Feel about you becoming a cartoonist?
I was good. Well, how did you become a cartoonist? That's what I'm dying to know, because people know you from the New Yorker, Ross. How did you become, you know, what you are?
Beautifully put, actually. That sort
really
of says it. Yeah.
I mean, were you good at drawing in school?
Yeah, I always drew. I always drew. And I always liked to write. And I liked making pictures that made me laugh. And I found things funny. And sometimes even if I was drawing something seriously, it would come out sort of funny. And
And then you sent cartoons in? I mean, you've
yes.
earned a living as a cartoonist. So you sent them
yeah.
to where, the New Yorker or other places first?
Well, I started out, I went to art school. I went to Rhode Island School of Design. And first I never thought I'd be able to make my living as a cartoonist, actually. I never really did. The first place that I really thought that I would wind up working was maybe the Village Voice. And that was, to me, the height of all, because Jules Pfeiffer
right.
worked for them. My parents subscribed to The New Yorker, so I knew The New Yorker used cartoons, but I didn't see my stuff as fitting in with them. And my dream was to work for The Village Voice, and I was selling them some cartoons. But I was also starting out, I was 23, and I thought I should probably, you know, I was selling some to the National Lampoon, I was selling to The Village Voice. There weren't, you know, tons and tons of markets. And I thought I should try The New Yorker. I mean, because there was The New Yorker and there was Playboy, and that was even less relatable to. I mean, I did try at one point to do Playboy cartoons at the behest of the woman who was the cartoon editor, whose name was Michelle Urey, and they came out like parodies of Playboy cartoons because I really, you know, they were like, I have bosoms. And, you know, I had no idea. It was like boss chasing secretary around desk and you have, look at your bosoms. And yes, I do have bosoms. I really had no idea like what kind of, you know, humor to find in this. But anyway, so I thought, okay, I'll get together. I'll find out when The New Yorker has, you know, their drop off day. And I called them up, and at that time, this was 1978, they took things on Wednesday, like over the transom things. So I put everything I had, about like 60 cartoons. I had no idea how to do this at all. And I didn't have anybody to ask. I just sort of thought, okay, I'll put the cartoons in this envelope, and I'll put my card in it, and then I'm sure they won't take anything, and I'll pick it up the next week, but I will have tried. I wasn't even like nervous because I was so sure that they weren't going to take anything.
How many before they took the first one?
They actually bought something from that group.
Wow. What did that feel like?
I was flabbergasted. I was just flabbergasted. And Lee Lorenz, who was the art director at the time, told me to start coming back to not just drop stuff off, but to actually come in to the actual part of the magazine.
But have I read somewhere that we had Bob Mankoff in here a couple
yeah.
of weeks ago. We were talking about a whole bunch of people, including you. Have you had 90, something like 90, we only have a minute left, like roughly 90% of your cartoons have been rejected by The New Yorker?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but it's not me. I mean, I probably do as well as anybody there. I'm sure there's people who have even...
Oh, he told us that.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of that, in his book, and I know that this is my... You have a cartoon that I will... It's called Insomnia Jeopardy, and here are the categories. Ways in which people have wronged me. Strange noises, diseases I probably have, money troubles, what did I say, why did I say do that, and ideas for a screenplay. Can you relate to that, Marjorie Egan, or
totally.
Can you not relate
and
to
I
that?
And I love the one about the everybody Velcroed to the wall.
The Velcro family. It's just unbelievable.
That's fantastic, too.
So, but answer my question before. We only have a minute. Oh. Were your parents okay with you being a cartoonist? Is that not like a real job for the family?
I think that they thought I would probably go into the family business, which was teaching.
Uh-huh.
My mother was an assistant principal. My father was a French and Spanish teacher. And I think that they thought that eventually I would wind up doing that. So it was possibly as much of a surprise to them as it continues to be a surprise to me that I you know, thank God, because I can't teach
It's not a surprise to us, Roz. Roz Chast's new book, it's a memoir. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? It is an amazing book.
It really is spectacular. Thanks, you want to get it for all your friends and certainly for yourself. Roz is going to be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7.
Tickets are sold out,
but there may be some scalpers. You can also catch her tonight on Greater Boston with Emily Rooney. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Alex Beam and Secretary of Transportation Rich Davey. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.